You're listening to Tad's Smart Talk, Christina. This isn't mellow listening. This is our introduction to our first guest. Please join me in welcoming Suzanne McCormick. Suzanne is the President and CEO of United Way of Greater Portland, and she is changing the world here in Maine. Welcome, Suzanne.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How do you like the theme song?
I loved it.
Change. It's a little bit, when Shani said, you know, the perfect song to introduce the CEO of United Way is about changing the world. I'm familiar with the song, but it's a little low key, isn't it?
But it's got good rhythm.
It's got good rhythm.
I think I'm going to hear it all day.
You may want to start playing that at the office.
I think I might.
You could make that your theme song wherever you walk into a room. Just say, I want to have Change the World played.
I loved it.
Fantastic. We usually start these talks. I don't really call them interviews because for me, it's more about learning about people here in Maine that are contributing in different ways and they're helping, or whether it has to do with government or politics or business. And I'm equally fascinated with both the person and the organization that typically they work with. So why don't we start with you in your background. I first must say that since we're taping this early in the production week, today is your birthday.
It is my
birthday. You are an April Fool's baby.
I have lived through a lot of April Fool baby jokes in my lifetime.
Does it ever get old? I mean, how do you, the contrast between people playing April Fool jokes on you and the contrast that your birthday is typically a day of celebration, how's that worked out?
It's been a little bit of a psychotic experience growing up.
It's like, you're doing good work, you want the cake and all the other kids for 364 days, they get all these special, and you get people, you know, pulling chairs out, telling you things that happened that aren't.
I got a lot of empty shoe boxes wrapped up as birthday presents over the years, or filled with like newspaper or toilet paper when I was a kid.
Wow.
People thought that was funny. Yeah. You know?
Any scarring based on that? Anything?
I don't know. I think I've worked it out.
We'll do another show on that. So talk a little bit about where you grew up, and then we'll talk about where you went to school and kind of how you got into the area of public service and how that led to being president and CEO of United Way of Greater Portland.
Well, I was raised in the South. I was born in the Midwest and quickly got taken down to Virginia and North Carolina. And so my formative years were in what I would consider the Deep South, which was an interesting experience.
The land of Waffle House?
Oh, yes.
I used to live in Atlanta.
Oh, we love Waffle House.
I love Waffle House. And I could not convince, and I still can't convince my wife, Katie, whenever we traveled back down there, because our two youngest children were born in Atlanta, the value of Waffle House. The jukebox, the way that all the vernacular, where you get them scrambled, covered, smothered, and something else.
When I was in high school, you could leave campus to go out for lunch, and there was a strip of restaurants, and Waffle House was like the most popular. You had to get off campus early to get in and get a seat for lunchtime.
And if you were ever studying late, like at 2 a.m., because I'm sure you were studying all the time at 2 a.m., you could go to the Waffle House, and it would always be there.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
An icon of the South.
And you went to Duke. We were talking about that, and now that we're in Final Four season, there must be a little bit of, you know, Duke has historically done so well in basketball, and Coach K is so respected that you must bleed blue just a little bit, huh?
I do, and it was sad. I tried to fire everyone at United Way who had Mercer beating Duke, but that didn't really go over. Yeah, I was sitting in the...
That almost doesn't even sound right. Mercer beats Duke.
You
think either North Carolina or one of the powerhouses.
Who is Mercer? Really?
Coming from a Duke grad, I'm sure there are Mercer grads out there going, what are you talking about? Mercer's a great school. But Coach K, you know, interesting coach, right? He's part of the fabric of Duke.
Greatest coach ever.
Really?
Yeah, like they raise us. When you get to Duke, you have to like take a class on the history of Coach K and how great he is. I mean, you get indoctrinated from, I think it's a mandatory class your freshman year.
That's fantastic. So you went to Duke and you had a bachelor's degree in political science and government. At what point did you decide in terms of your academic career that you had an interest in the field of either poli-sci or government or civil or civic service, anything like that?
Two things happened. One, I took a class my junior year. It was called Interns in Social Consciousness. And you studied about social issues, and it was really, I think, as an adult, one of my first exposures to service as a career. So we studied that. And so I found that really interesting, and yet I thought that I was probably going to become a public servant in terms of through the judicial system. But one day I was walking through the common room of my dorm, and in the wastebasket there was this brightly covered piece of paper, and I felt compelled to get it out of the wastebasket. And it was a flyer for an open house about the Peace Corps. And wow. I was intrigued by it, and I went to the open house, and you know, they show this great slideshow, and it's this idea of traveling overseas and helping, you know, change the world.
Right.
And that's when I got the bug, and I decided that that would be a really interesting path to take. And I would also say that at that point in time, everybody at Duke, I felt like, was going to go work on Wall Street or be a high-powered attorney. It was all about making money, and this felt really different.
So this was about 20 years ago, something like that?
Yeah, I think it's a little longer than
that.
We'll
round.
You didn't ask me how old I was today, so I appreciate
we're
that.
We're not going to ask that, but round.
Yeah, it was the late 80s.
Late 80s.
Yeah.
And you found it in a trash can. Yeah. That will
I
have,
say I found my career in a trash can.
That has to be part of the made-for-TV movie. The Suzanne McCormick story. That is so classic, by the way.
Could hear the music. Like, you could have heard the music in the common room, and I see the piece of paper, and
I see it
up.
In slow motion. I see the camera, like, you know, zooming in, seeing it, and I see you, you know, looking. You know, there's another poster somewhere about some band on campus. You go from there, and you look at the basket, and you make the decision. That's fantastic.
That's it. And that's what did it. So at that point, I continued to tell my parents that law school was plan A, and I introduced the Peace Corps as plan B, but really the Peace Corps was my plan A, and law school was plan B.
That's funny. We have Suzanne McCormick here. She's president and CEO of United Way of Greater Portland. You're listening to Tides from Our Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. For people that may not be familiar, Peace Corps is one of those things, I believe, that everyone recognizes the name because it's iconic. Many people are familiar with some of the work, but I don't think all of our listeners may understand exactly what the Peace Corps. If you wouldn't mind just taking a minute and just kind of talking a little bit about, from your perspective, when you were a volunteer with the Peace Corps, but the work that they did, and then when you volunteered, the work that you did, and then today, really what the Peace Corps is about.
Well, the original idea of the Peace Corps was to have Americans go and help in countries that were developing. So, obviously it was countries that could benefit from learning, I think, from America at the time. I think what I came to discover in my experience in the Peace Corps, probably more important than what people learned from me, was what I learned from them,
right.
I think. I mean, it really is, I think it's as much a cultural exchange program as it is, and a thought exchange as it is a developmental program. So I went to Thailand, and my job was to teach English in a middle school to kids. And it was important to Thailand for them to have English teachers because kids who could speak English had much better opportunity to, you know, go on to secondary education and to help build the economy in Thailand, which now I don't even know if they have a Peace Corps program anymore. A country has to qualify. There have to be some criteria. I mean, it's a country that could benefit from some development. So I got to go live in a very small village about 70 kilometers south of the Laotian border, up in the northeastern part of Thailand, really poor part of the country. We called it the Dust Bowl because it was...
Did you speak Thai?
Your first 3 months in the country, just all you do is study the language for 8 hours a day.
Wow.
And you get dropped in to live with a family that doesn't speak any English. And so you learn it pretty quickly. It's a hard language, though. I mean, it's easy. Well, it's hard to learn. It's so different than English because it's a very tonal language and really hard to learn to read and write, too.
Wow. So,
but I was really good at it.
I'm guessing you were. How long were you in Thailand?
Just under 3 years.
That's a long time.
I know.
That's a lot of service. I mean,
but you know what? Almost, well, I will say there was a lot that changed in the world because that's when we...
A lot of people kind of drop in on programs. And, you know, Angelina Jolie, who I think does some great work around the world, and I think she's an ambassador at the UN. It feels like she kind of drops in for a couple of days at a time and then drops out, and not to diminish her contributions, and I think that she is, she's done a lot of great work. But being somewhere, as you described, for 3 years feels different than kind of parachuting in.
I think it is, and I think that's one of the, I think that is by design. As I said earlier, you know, I really think I got more out of it than I gave to it, and that is, it was really this understanding of what it's like to live as the outsider in a community.
Right.
And so when I came back, so they had this word for white person there. It was farang. And everywhere you went, and I'm a little bit taller than, I'm tall by nature.
Than the average person.
And definitely taller than the average Thai person.
Right.
So I was the tall white girl that would walk through a town, and people would stare at you and say, farang, farang, farang. So you got to have an appreciation for what it is like to be the person that looks really different and is really different in a society, and that taught me a ton of humility. I mean, you couldn't learn that kind of humility other than being in that situation, I think.
That's fascinating. And after Thailand, talk a little bit about your career path. And after 3 years in Thailand, what were the next steps?
Well, I took my time coming home. I had a great opportunity to go travel through India and Nepal. So I took about 3 months to do that, which was an incredible experience.
Just traveling, just backpacking, hostels, or what was that
experience? Yeah, all that, young 20s. I was with a group of four other Peace Corps volunteers, and we went up to Nepal, we hiked for a month, and then came down to India and traveled pretty much around the whole country, and just absorbed the culture and laid on the beach and got to meet new people and read a lot. And yeah, it was incredible, incredible country. I mean, there's so much to see there.
Well, what is India like? Because
crowded. It's very,
there's a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
And it is, just by based on size and population, is considered a growing, if not world power, certainly playing a bigger role, cultural, business, economic role in the world. And for Westerners, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of awareness. There's pop culture references. There's movies that kind of depict parts of it. But from your experience, how would you kind of describe being in India?
I think the single most important aspect of India that sets it apart from a lot of countries, I think, is how much spirituality and their faith is a part of everyday culture. So, and there's convergence of different religions there, Hinduism, Muslims, Christianity, and it's everywhere, and it all fits really nicely together in most places. And you just don't see that, I think, in other countries in the same way as you see it in India. And I really can't overstate what it's like to be in a place where there are so many people. Like, you are in crowds of people constantly.
Like the trains are crowded, the marketplace is crowded. There's
everything.
Just a mass of people.
Yeah. The hardest thing to find there was space.
That's funny. So after that, you know, I think there's an Indian term, Chautauqua, journey. So after your Chautauqua, after you spent time in Thailand, and then you visited India and Nepal, you came back and you're thinking, all right, I've done service. Now I need to kind of get on a career path. Mm-hmm. I need to pay the bills. I need to put this great Duke education to work. What were the next steps?
I was really lucky to find a job in a very natural place after India, New York City, you know, where it's one of the most populous cities in America.
You wanted to be around a lot of people.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah. So through the Peace Corps Network, I found a job at a really cool organization in New York City. It's called the International Center in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a place that still exists, and it helps newly arrived immigrants, refugees, international business people get acclimated to life in New York City. So it was a perfect place to land because I still got to have a lot of exposure to other cultures. And I was working in a nonprofit that was helping them you know, get used to life here. And so it was in some ways similar when I got to Thailand. People had to help me get right. used to life in Thailand. So it was a really, it was a nice way to get back into working in America.
In another densely populated sea of yeah. humanity.
So. And at that point in time, I was really interested in this multicultural education exchange and thought that's what I wanted to do. At that point in time, there weren't a lot of programs about multicultural education. And so I actually started doing some master's work in that, but I was having to invent the program and it just wasn't happening. And so I focused on my job in New York City, which was running this huge volunteer program. We matched Americans with international visitors, and they would meet on a one-on-one basis weekly to have conversations. And I started to learn about nonprofit management, had a really great boss, and I loved it.
Well, we have Suzanne McCormick here. She's president and CEO of United Way of Greater Portland, and I definitely want to get to the work that you're doing here in Greater Portland and Maine, but talk a little bit about, you know, your experience in terms of teaching and working overseas and in New York, your reflections on how Americans see other cultures and other cultures see America, because for many reasons. One, we're now part of a global economy that's never turning back. Mm-hmm. So 100 years ago, we didn't have mass transportation, mass communication, and the economy wasn't involving, you know, basically everyone around the globe. Now in the year 2014, here in America and here in Maine, everyone is connected literally and figuratively, whether it's by the internet or by trade or by commerce and in some ways education. From your experience, do you think America, you know, it's obviously a generalization, but do you think we have the right approach to being world citizens? Or just what are your thoughts about being, you know, what it means to be an American and see so many different cultures and see particularly people in need? Because in many of the situations you were in developing countries that you were either teaching or volunteering and helping. It wasn't that you were immersed in prosperity. You were helping people with some real, very, very immediate needs.
I thought this when I got back from the Peace Corps, and I think it still holds true. I think Americans, this is a generalization, I think that we definitely have a tendency to be judgmental of other cultures and countries and think that our way is better than others. And I think that is due mostly, in fact, that there are not enough Americans who have had the opportunity to experience other cultures and so therefore don't have an appreciation. I think it was really easy when I went into the Peace Corps to look at this very small village that I was going to live in and you know, start with some judgment around they're poor, their life must be really bad because they struggle. And yet what I found there was life was simple. It was simpler than ours, and it was still incredibly rich and in some aspects richer than an American lifestyle. So I think, you know, it's a generality, but I think when people aren't exposed or don't let themselves learn about other cultures or different kinds of people, it's easy to be judgmental and think our way is better. And I think that still holds true today. I think we can apply that to social issues as well. I think that what works in our favor, however, is the trends around globalization and technology. People can access information so much more than they ever were and could. So shame on us if we don't, you know, increase our understanding and therefore our openness around people who are different than we are.
I agree. We have Suzanne McCormick here, President and CEO of United Way of Greater Portland. So ultimately, you made your way to Maine. So why don't we talk about that? What was your first introduction to Maine? How you end up here, and then let's talk about what's going on with the United Way of Greater Portland.
I think my first introduction to Maine was, had to be a trip with it would have been my fiancé at the time, my husband now.
Right.
His family had a summer home in Maine for his entire life, and so this was always a vacation spot. So I am one of those people who got exposed to Maine because it was vacation land and fell in love with it.
Perfect.
Fell in love with the lifestyle. And when we decided that we were, it was time to leave New York City, we tried to be really intentional about where we wanted to live. We had met in Colorado. And so we have this love of the outdoors, and we wanted to be someplace that was going to allow us to continue to, you know, have that, follow our pursuits. And so, you know, job opportunity came, and it was easy to say yes. We had actually already had our wedding planned in Maine. So, you know, we knew that we loved it. And then when we found that we could have careers here, it was like an enormous bonus.
That is a bonus. It is amazing to me how many people I've interviewed and talked to, and both men and women. In my case, I grew up in Boston, but I was down in Atlanta, and I met my wife down in Atlanta, who is from Bangor. And so many people, it's like, for the love of a good woman or a good man, it's like, you know, that should be part of the main economic development story.
I agree.
Go bring somebody back. Go bring a spouse, a life partner. Bring somebody back and be part of Maine.
Yeah, it happens over and over again.
It worked for me. Seems to work well for you.
I think it's also, people choose to live here. Like, a lot of people do choose to live here, which is one of the reasons I think makes it a really special place.
I actually think you're onto something. I think not only do people choose to live here, but there's something about the DNA or the ethos of Maine where, whether you go back 200 years ago, when Maine couldn't have been the most comfortable place to, you know, before electricity, before antibiotics and all the other stuff. So for people who settled here, there was something about the land. There's something about the DNA, the cultural, social DNA, where to be in Maine at a certain point, you have to say, this is where I want to be. And for people that stay here and grow their families and commit and work, you know, we have here at TideSmart, we've over the last few years hired quite a few people. And we have never had much success recruiting people from outside of Maine in trying to fit them into the company. By living here, we have had 99.9% more success finding people here in Maine that already know they want to be here, and then possibly training them in whatever the job is or the technical thing, because you either feel it or you don't. And that is kind of unique. There are people that live in other places. They're like, well, I can live in Dallas, or I can live in Houston, or maybe I can go live in Oklahoma. But Maine, you kind of have to want to be here.
No, I agree. Yeah, there's a sense of pride that I'm pretty sure you wonder if people in Illinois say, oh, I just love Illinois. Or
everyone has their own kind of support or their loyalty to where they grew up. By the way, you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We have Suzanne McCormick here. She is President and CEO of United Way of Greater Portland. So, Red Cross, you came back and joined the American Red Cross here in Southern Maine.
Well, actually, when I moved to Maine, I worked for a couple years for United Way. Not a couple years, I worked for 8 years.
Wow.
That was my first job in Maine. Got a lot of exposure to the work of United Way, and then went to Red Cross. And Red Cross was a, I worked for Red Cross during Hurricane Katrina, which was probably one of the biggest moments in that organization's history. It was an incredible experience. I mean, even when just being in Maine, I'm sort of speechless when I think back on it. I was on vacation. So I was working for Red Cross. I was actually on vacation in Alaska visiting my father when Hurricane Katrina happened, and ended up coming home a week early from that just because there was so much happening in the organization.
Here in Maine, or did you go down to New Orleans?
I did not. I stayed in Maine. There was a lot of activity at the time. I don't know if you recall, but there was this movement to move refugees from Louisiana to all parts of the country. So we started this planning effort. The governor got a call. Governor Baldacci at the time got a call. And for a pretty intense period of time, we thought that we were getting 500 families from Louisiana coming to get resettled in Maine, at least temporarily.
And so you had to work on the plan, the infrastructure, the support, all that?
Yeah. It was an incredible experience. Yeah.
One of the highlights for me in the political realm was when President Bush got down there in the airport hangar, and the head of FEMA, Brownie, where he went up to him and said, way to go, Brownie. And again, I don't want to get off into a tangent, but Brownie was like the head of some equestrian thing, and he was a political appointee.
And it all started to fall apart.
He was busy buying suits and getting his hair done. And so that quote, way to go, Brownie, to me is symbolic of something else, and it's more of the political realm. But things like that, FEMA, things like safety organizations, emergency organizations, American Red Cross, shouldn't be politicized. But it just seemed like that one little exchange where the President of the United States is coming in, people are still going through such pain. There's death, there's destruction, families have been torn apart, and Brownie wasn't doing anything.
Yeah, there's a lesson in speaking less sometimes, I think. You know, what I found so interesting around the whole experience was you have to build a certain amount of infrastructure in any organization to be able to have consistency of response. And yet sometimes that infrastructure becomes too constraining and starts to inhibit your ability to be flexible,
right.
Which I think that was the greatest lesson for Red Cross in that experience was you got to have enough structure, but you also have to have flexibility. And I think that that tension was tested to the breaking point probably in that disaster.
Before we start talking about the United Way of Greater Portland, talk a little bit about American Red Cross here in Maine. Because again, it's another organization that people are familiar with, but what is the mandate here at TideSmart? Once or twice a year, we have a blood drive, and we do a which we think is great. But most people are just familiar with that as being the kind of the clearinghouse for national blood supply and then first response or support response when there's disasters. But from your experience, talk a little bit about what the Red Cross does here in Maine.
Well, there are really four lines of business. You've hit on two of them. One is definitely blood. Hugely important, hugely critical, you know, one of the biggest providers of blood in the country. We're going to need it forever. And then disaster services is the second largest. And that's really an insurance policy, not only at the national level for big disasters, but also for local communities. You know, right now, if there's a fire in any community in Maine, the Red Cross in Maine has the ability to send volunteers to meet families to help them, you know, get their immediate needs met. And then less known but still really important, Red Cross plays a really important role in training people in CPR, health and safety. Lots of kids learn to swim under the Red Cross or babysit under the Red Cross. And then the last line of business, which is really less known but still really important, I think, for some families, they're a direct link to military, between military families and their service personnel in times of emergency. So, you know, Red Cross is... It's part of the fabric of, I think, not only the country but local communities too. Just in being able to save lives through blood and through disaster services. See, I can still speak Red Cross.
I think it's an important thing. Red Cross is important, but how do people? It's one of those things where it feels like it's this iconic thing and it's always there, but you never really see it. Organizationally.
Well, hopefully, you don't want to see it.
Well, you don't want it. If you're in the middle of a disaster, you know, it's both good and bad. You know, if the Red Cross shows up, something bad is happening. Yeah. But how do people become involved with the Red Cross? And it feels like it is such an important mandate. And we'll talk about all the other United Way organizations, the different organizations that you kind of connect with. But the blood part of it, the military part of it, the disaster part of it, it doesn't feel it feels like it becomes activated at the point of critical need, but we don't talk about or kind of celebrate or recognize just the infrastructure of it existing. Like right now today, there's no blizzard going on. There's no, you know, we're not in a very big earthquake zone. There's no Vermont isn't attacking us, so there's no big, you know, our borders are safe and we're... But the Red Cross is still there and it's still operating, doing really important things.
I think that's always a challenge. Like leading the Red Cross was you made the news when something awful happened,
right.
And that's when people are aware of it. I think there are lots of ways for people to get involved. I mean, blood drives and giving blood is everyday need. So if people wanted to be a part of that, but also Red Cross has a really strong volunteer program that in these times of quiet or non-disaster, they are constantly looking to recruit folks and get them trained so that when there is a need for a response, people are ready to go. And it's also a really fun opportunity. I shouldn't say fun. It's a great opportunity for people, especially folks who have the chance to move around or spend time. If you get trained locally in disaster response, for example, you can get assigned to go work on a national disaster. And that can be a really interesting experience for people.
So you are the leader of the Red Cross here in Southern Maine, CEO?
Yes.
Fantastic. That was until 2007, is that right?
2007, yes. And then I went and I worked for, I was the CEO at PROP, People's Regional Opportunity Program, which is Cumberland County's community action agency, provides a lot of the most basic services for people living in poverty. And after 2 years, that's when I made my way back to United Way. So I, 2010, I guess, is when I came back.
And at that point, you became president and CEO of United Way of Greater Portland.
I did.
Fantastic. Why don't we talk a little bit about, before we talk about the work and the programs, let's talk about organizationally, what is the United Way and what is Greater Portland? I mean, are there different organizations in terms of Northern Maine, and how big is the scope of organizationally the United Way of Greater Portland?
There are, so across the country, there are 1,200 United Ways. Almost every community in America is connected somehow to a United Way. In Maine, we have 10. The United Way of Greater Portland is the largest United Way. And so we serve all of the folks living in Cumberland County. Like, that's our primary area. So we have the largest population. And our work is really about, we have a pretty lofty mission, but it's a great mission. And that is really to create opportunities for everyone to live the lives that they want to lead. And we focus on making sure there's equity in education, in financial stability, and health. And it's because those three things have to come together for someone to have a good life. And so that's what all of our work is about.
And what other organizations? I know that there's obviously we have Big Brothers Big Sisters. I'm on the board of Boys and Girls Clubs, and when people think about United Way, I think sometimes they think of it as an umbrella group where these other very important organizations kind of connect with. If you can explain a little bit kind of the structure and the hierarchy, whether it has to do with funding or programming, how the United Way and these other organizations kind of interact?
So the easiest way, I think, to explain it is to think about our work along two tracks. One is that we are really committed to making sure essential programs exist in our community to help individuals. And so those are programs like Boys and Girls Club, American Red Cross, Big Brothers Big Sisters. And those programs focus on helping individuals get better in a certain area. So, you know, Boys and Girls Club are about helping kids improve their academic achievement and their leadership skills. Boys and Girls Club, similar. And then there are programs that really focus on health or mental health. So that's a big part of our work, is making sure that there are all these essential programs in our community thriving so that people can get help that they need. I think as importantly, we also focus on how to make those programs work better together, and how to make those programs and organizations not just work better together, like program to program, but also with different institutions in the community. So much of our work now, and I think our best work, is happening where we are, instead of umbrella, I would say we're sort of the glue that helps connect programs to, for example, school systems and local government and local business, so that we can all work together towards common goals. And we've got some great examples of that happening in Portland, in South Portland, in Westbrook right now, where we pull all these different entities together to try to figure out, for example, how to help kids succeed in school.
Well, let's talk about the before we get into specifics of some of the programs and the specific groups. You know, you mentioned that there's an umbrella of policy of helping people in need, whether it's education, whether it has to do with health care. Clearly here in Maine and all across the country, there are issues with mental health care that show up in all kinds of ways, whether it has to do with prison system, whether it has to do with violence, whether it has to do with... And in a country of about 300 million people, and here in Maine with 1.3 million people, and you oversee kind of the area of Cumberland County, when you have that number of people, at various times, there will be various contact points of people needing help. It's either situational, circumstantial, it's the weather, and they can't afford heat, lose a job, and you have kids that have health vulnerabilities. So people, I think we recognize in our society that as part of kind of our American DNA, we help people that need help. And we do that within our borders. We do that outside in terms of foreign aid. But it's kind of part of our history that when we see people in need, our instinct is to say, coming from kind of a humanitarian point of view, we should do something to help that person or that group of people. We're also coming through an economic period where there's a greater challenge to the concept of government policy and federal state budgets being allocated to help people. So before we talk about the viability and the effectiveness of specific programs, which I support completely, talk a little bit about where you think there's been a shift in either state or federal policy that governs it. Because if there's not money and if there's not legislative support to help people, the individual programs are downstream and we're not doing enough to help people that really truly need help. And from your experience over a couple of decades of your own personal service in Thailand and traveling around the world and being part of the Red Cross and now the head of United Way in Greater Portland, have you seen a shift in either the citizen universe of people feeling that we need help or the government? And if so, shouldn't we be focusing there as much as we are on the individual programming?
I think we are a great example as an organization that we have seen shifts, and we realize that simply focusing on individual programming is not necessarily going to change a systemic problem. A great example, I worked last year on a task force in Portland that was focused on homelessness. And if just simply creating more programs for people who are homeless are not necessarily going to get to some of the systemic issues. So you could have all the shelter in the world, but if you don't also have systems that you can connect people to job training and other resources, just addressing one program, addressing one symptom doesn't change it for people. And so I think that mindset is becoming much more prevalent. And so people are thinking, we have some new language that we use. It's called collective impact. I think people are trying to think, how do you work collectively around an issue or a goal as opposed to individual agencies trying to do it alone? So without question, that mindset is alive and well, and it is the future of how, to me, it's very intuitive. It makes all the sense in the world, but it's still a relatively new concept for programs who have been used to sort of putting their heads down and serving their clientele. There's a realization now that people have to look up and work better together. I think one of the greatest challenges, just in state government and in federal government, and I think it's been with us and it's still with us. I think politicians are, or policymakers are, as much as they want to focus on the long term and long term change, they are driven by the short term because of their tenure in office and people looking at them in the here and now. And so I think so much of what we could do to really change some of the issues in our community, take preventative measures, like we got to invest early and stay with those investments. But that's hard to do when you've got immediate concerns. Like, to hold true to a long-term change vision is incredibly challenging for state government and federal government. And yet, it's really what we know can, if you can invest with kids early and stay with them, you will prevent them from needing all these other services further down the line. But we give up early intervention and early preventative investments for something that has a more immediate impact. Because if you're in office, you want to see what's going to happen tomorrow. You're not necessarily caring about what's going to happen 15 years from now because you're not going to get the recognition.
Exactly.
Sort of my soapbox on.
No, I want to go in a little more detail with that. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. You know, those examples that you've talked about, I think, are right on. We had Mark Swan, also known as Swanee to people in the community, the head of Preble Street, on here a few months ago, and we were talking about various social issues. One of the things that have kind of come to the forefront, I think, in the Portland City Council was panhandling in Franklin Arterial. And I think he made some excellent points, and I'm paraphrasing, but part of his point was, you know, the issue is bigger than people on Franklin Arterial panhandling for money. There are issues that create long-term unemployment. There's housing issues. There is mental illness. There are dependency issues. And the more that we just focus on the small kind of myopic situational stuff. We aren't solving the bigger issues.
Agreed.
And from the policy standpoint, what we've been hearing a lot in the last month coming out of Augusta, because these are difficult financial times for the state and for other states and the country itself, but the idea of social programs coming under attack and some of the, I don't want to say the ammunition, but some of the arguments about those have to do with things like food stamps or somebody being on some sort of support program using a food stamp in Nevada or Texas, in that being used as evidence that there's widespread abuse or that we should somehow fund less because, you know, any big system, there are going to be situational abuses, but the argument of how important some of these programs are gets lost.
So you asked me earlier in the show about what it was like to live in Thailand, and I talked about my sort of Americans' perceptions of other cultures, and I'm getting someplace with this.
Sure.
One of the most interesting things when I got to Thailand, their perception of Americans were that every male, every American man was like Rambo, because they got that from...
Rambo.
Right. And every American woman was cheating on her husband and wearing short dresses. So it was like this very negative, you know, depiction of Americans. And they saw it all in movies, so they thought that that's who they thought that's who we are. I think the same thing happens with social issues and what you use for people who are panhandling or people who are homeless or the one, you know, this very small percentage of someone who misuses a benefit, they become the poster child for all people who get benefits. And therefore, you know, we let the one negative stand for the whole. And the majority of people who are getting services and help are people who they do not want to be in the situation they're in.
Right.
And yet it's easy because we don't understand. We don't take time to really get to know what is the issue. We don't take time
to stand
in their shoes.
Because we're at a point with communication, the internet, and media where in many ways we have more access to more information, not in many ways, in every meaningful way, ever in human history, we have more access. You know, I can pick up my iPhone here and within 5 seconds find out the most, you know, specific detail on the economy, on political issues, on how the cast of Gilligan's Island doing after all these years, how to make tapioca pancakes, whatever, the most obscure. So people have access to information. But in some areas, the more technology we have, it feels like people revert to kind of base, you know, I don't want to say prejudice, but really limited views. And when it comes to social service programs, people take this shortcut of, yeah, people are abusing the, we've got to get all the freeloaders off of the system because they're really hurting it for the rest of us. And it just feels so misplaced.
I agree with you. I think it does feel misplaced. And I don't know, I guess my personal take on it is perhaps it's easier to blame than it really is to get your hands around the complexity of an issue. Because when you start to understand why people are in some of the situations, it's really discouraging from a societal point of view. You think about how much you actually have to fix to
right.
make it better for people than simply get a job or get off the street. I just think it's the easy out.
Okay, we've got Suzanne McCormick here. Let's talk about some of the other programs that right now United Way of Greater Portland are working on, some specific programs that are helping people in different ways and that also our listeners can be more involved with. By the way, anything we've talked about here, and if you want to get in touch with Suzanne herself, the website's www.unitedwaygp, which stands for greaterportland.org. So their information is right there. But talk about specific programming that United Way of Greater Portland is involved in right now.
Well, I came from a meeting this morning which gave me so much hope. So I can share. I think it's a great example. I mentioned earlier, it's an example that is getting replicated in Portland and in South Portland. But I was at a meeting this morning with the superintendent of schools from the Westbrook School Department, with two business leaders from that community, with the head of the school department. The mayor would have been there, except that she was out of town.
She was here a few weeks ago.
She's
great.
And what we were talking about was this vision for kids succeeding from the minute they're born till they, you know, get to a career. And that project that's happening in Westbrook is having, and what it is about what I talked about earlier. It's about bringing different programs and volunteerism and public policy, all this stuff that exists in the community together in an aligned way. And I actually heard one of the members of this meeting today say, it really feels different than it felt a year ago, the way that we're working together and how that has turned into like great results is that based on this ability to work better and bring programs to work better, kids in Westbrook, their reading scores have gone up, their math scores have gone up in the third and fourth grade. The number of issues that kids have around behavior have decreased. And so we have proven that this methodology of coming together and working under this collective impact model actually has great results for kids and for community. And that model is the model that we're most proud of and that we're most eager to engage communities in throughout Cumberland County, because we've got three great examples of how it's working. And there's so many different ways for people to be part of it, from volunteering on a one-time basis, on a long-time basis, being part of planning, providing in-kind resources, financial resources. It's just everyone can be a part of it.
But when you talk about people, everyone can be involved, you know, specifically, what's the best portal, literally or figuratively, for people to go from hearing Suzanne McCormick talk about it on the radio to say, I really want to, is it to go through your website, to go through other websites, and what's the best mechanism?
It's very easy. Go through our website, and there's a tab on our website that says volunteer, and that will take you to information on how to connect to a volunteer opportunity that you're passionate about, how to get connected to some of the work that we're doing specifically in a specific community or issue. So it's really easy to do. We have a fabulous website. It's get connected, but go through our website to get to the volunteer tab, and you can get access to all kinds of information on how to get involved.
And you're also very, very active on Twitter.
Some days.
No, I think that
we want to be.
Your Twitter feed is at United Way GP. In fact, why don't we talk a little bit about how our worlds kind of intersected last month?
That was one of the most interesting intersections I've been a part of in a long time.
It involved high stakes gambling. It involved athletics in using the term very loosely. It involved, I thought, was just a real fun interaction.
Well, someone on my staff discovered that you like to play ping pong, and they somehow got into their heads that I actually was good at ping pong, and so challenged you.
Wasn't just good. I think the reference was you were training for the Olympics, or that you had your time in Thailand. Yeah, there was you went to some sort of special ping pong school in your part time, something like that.
Well, I guess I can have a colorful personality in the workplace, so they could imagine I had done anything.
Exactly.
And so challenged you to a ping pong duel, which you so generously agreed to. And then you're the one who threw in the high stakes around charity and offered to make a contribution, which I thought was so interesting, is that you were going to give us more if you won than if I won, which wasn't that big of an incentive for me to really play my hardest against you.
Well, we may need a rematch. We may need to recalibrate the stakes to get it more in line. I thought it was really interesting because, first of all, relative to Twitter, I feel, and compared to, you know, your staff that manage your Twitter feed, who are experts, and they navigate the Twitter highway with great speed and finesse, I feel like a 14-year-old driving on the turnpike for the first time on Twitter. So it's like I just watched Academy Awards look like fun. You know, so I'm tweeting in the most rudimentary and in the most, awkward. But all of a sudden, I start getting these tweets from United Way GP challenging me to double reverse ping pong tournaments with the CEO of United Way. And it was all in just such great fun. It was really interesting, and it was just fun. So it was for me, speaking as a business owner, I would love to be more involved with organizations that really add a sense of kind of community involvement and fun rather than just kind of the very dry, hey, we're this charity, we're doing this, and will you donate or do this? And so that's why I thought it was just a very cool interaction.
Well, when you asked earlier how people can get involved, we would love to hear from people on Twitter. We would love to hear what they care about, what they think we should care about, and also on our Facebook page. I think, you know, social media is such – I agree with you. I think it's such a wonderful new way for us to communicate with people and hear about what they care about, even though we can't see them on a daily basis. So,
and who handles your Twitter feed, by the way?
Jess Esch is on my team, and she's probably one of the most remarkable people that you could meet.
I think so, too.
She's at Jess30, if anyone wanted to follow her on Twitter. She's pretty amazing.
She's one of those folks who does zoom along the social highway at high speeds. But with great finesse, with great skill.
Absolutely. And I think she definitely got me into the world and keeps me in the world. And it's one of the most interesting, fun places to be sometimes.
Absolutely. We have Suzanne McCormick here. She's president and CEO of United Way of Greater Portland. And you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. And in the last couple of minutes we have, why don't we look forward in terms of, you know, we're here, by the way. Happy birthday again. We're taping this early in the week, and Suzanne was April. I don't want to say April. It sounds awful to say you're an April Fool's baby.
I've heard it my whole life.
I know you have. You've kind of been inoculated, but still it feels awkward. You were born on April 1st, so happy birthday as we record this. But what is the future of groups like United Way? And obviously, there will always be people in need. There will always be situations and circumstances and tragedy and natural disasters that require people to pull together. But do you see any fundamental changes going forward in terms of either technology or people or volunteer service, or is it just core humanity that really needs to be tapped into for people to help other people in need?
Well, I think you got to start with core humanity, but I think the future holds such opportunity, and I think United Ways are uniquely positioned as a connecting point for people who care about what's happening in their community and want to get connected to it. I think our United Way, we pride ourselves in, we want to find ways to work smarter, better together with limited resources. We want to use the best ideas. We want to use innovation. We want to connect through technology. We want to be a leader, I think, in finding new ways to do really hard work for the benefit of people who are most in need. And we want more people to be part of our work. And so I don't think there's any organization that offers what we can offer to someone who wants to get connected to complex issues, but in meaningful ways. And I also will say that we want to learn from the smartest people in our community, and we want to invite people into the solutions with us. And so please let us hear from you.
I think that's great. And for people that want to get in touch, they just go to www.unitedwaygp.org, or as we talked about, your ultra-fast, ultra-detailed Twitter feed at United Way GP, and plus you've got Facebook, Instagram. Yeah, I mean, you're social media. You guys
try to be hip.
You don't try. Don't even put try in there. We should edit try out. You are hip, very hip, and it was a pleasure when I had Mark Swanee on in terms of Preble Street. We've also had Peter Brown from Strive, and they do some really great work. And other organizations over the years, and in the same vein, the work that you're doing and all the people at United Way, I really think it's a selfless effort, and the people that are committed, whether it's volunteering or people within the organization, deserve all the credit and all the positive attention in the world. So thank you so much for the work that you do and everyone at United Way does in Greater Portland.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want you to come back and we'll play ping pong again. We'll have, there'll be more events to drive more interest in the United Way of Greater Portland.
Thanks, Steve.
You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.